Today I speak to S.A. Jones, author of The Fortress. Jones's previous novels are Red Dress Walking and Isabel of the Moon and Stars. She's authored dozens of opinion pieces and essays on politics, history, sexuality, public policy, and theology. The Fortress offers a fascinating, timely, and often challenging alternative to patriarchal society. The Fortress itself is many things: a self-sustaining city-state run by women, a space to atone for toxic corporate masculinity, and the site of male sexual submission. But it is also a meticulously wrought and beautifully depicted parallel universe of rolling hills, crashing waves, gardens lush with herbs and flowers, storms and sunshine. This is much more than a novel of ideas. It's a beautifully crafted, warm and entertaining work by the author at the peak of her powers. To step into the fortress is to be altered forever. I'm your host, Danny V. If you enjoy this episode, you might also like to hear from Andrew Hutchinson, author of One, or Angela Meyer chat about A Superior Spectre, or Megan Golden take us through her psychological thriller, The Escape Room, or hear Sarah Bailey chat about her series Into the Night and The Dark Lake.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Fortress is an incredibly thought-provoking novel, and it gave me pause for thought a number of times. Before we dig a little deeper into the novel, can I ask what influenced you to write this novel, The Fortress?
I'm not aware of any particular moment when I thought I have to write this book. I honestly think it's been an accretion of about 30 years' experience of femaleness that at a particular point I felt ready to write.
Yeah, it's really interesting that because when you said femaleness, when I was reading it and all the subtleties of submission and consent, you could really relate to that as a female. And I thought, wow, this, I can't believe I haven't read a story like this before because I found it so unique. So you're absolutely right about that. Just that living with that femaleness and even that subtlety of that misogyny throughout our society, it's just ever present, isn't it?
Isn't it? And what I've always found so interesting is we've got fabulous books about the experience of femaleness. And, you know, I've been really flattered to have comparisons to The Handmaid's Tale, Natural Way of Things, Left Hand of Darkness. But what I've found so interesting is none of those books really touch on the issue of what does it take for a man to change?
That's what I thought was interesting too, because it was from the, although it was about that femaleness, it's from the male perspective, which I thought was quite interesting.
And that gave me the opportunity to create this obverse universe where what we would typically expect in terms of power dynamics, consent, objectification, is inverted. And I think the benefit to that is you can look at it with fresh eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Fortress is a very interesting place. And what I'd like you to do, for those who have or haven't read it, there's no spoilers in this interview, but on page 9, it really describes The Fortress, and it begins, you know, The Fortress is not a jail. Would you mind reading a bit of that page so you can give us a bit of context about what we're talking about?
Certainly. So in the following paragraphs, one of the main characters, who is a vake by the name of Mandalay, is explaining the terms and conditions by which Jonathan, the anti-hero, will be confined at the fortress. And she says, "The fortress is not a jail, although you will be held under guard if you break our laws. You're not a prisoner, but your movements, your time, your labour will be almost entirely regulated. The vake will direct when and what you eat, when you sleep, when you rise. Every 11th day, you will have half a day to spend according to your inclination and wishes. This is known as the half. You're free to roam around a prescribed area of the grounds. On all other days, the spaces you inhabit and what you do there will be directed by us." Perhaps the most difficult thing to grasp about your relationship to us is the nature of your submission. While you stay with us, you are to obey all vague commands, and you are forbidden to ask questions of us unless explicitly authorized. But we are not in a master-serf relationship. You are not chattel, and our obligations to you are as strong and binding as those you owe to us. When you come to us, it must be in a state of willingness to empty yourself out and entrust yourself to us. Without that trust, your supplicancy will be futile. You may as well return to your life right now. Your subjectivity must be given to us freely and entirely. We will keep it until you return through the Veya Gate. We will not return it beforehand under any circumstances.
Now, when you're creating an entirely different world with different laws, how difficult was that to create? Because you're not only creating new characters and relationships, you're creating a kind of a whole new world there as well, in parallel to the world that we know.
True. And that's where I think my academic training was actually quite helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the deep, dark recesses of time, I did a PhD in history. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what makes a particular civilization, what makes it unique, and what differentiates it from other things. So I was able to draw on that in creating the Vague. But as I mentioned earlier, I almost had a template because I wanted to create this upside-down world. And when I started to think about it, I found I could create that by flipping and inverting what is so familiar to us in our current world.
Absolutely. And the Vague's ideologies are complex, as Jonathan must willingly choose to be submissive, which I thought was an interesting idea, and brought up questions about what is real submission and if submission is being entered too willingly. Why was this important for you to explore?
I'm hoping to prompt readers to think about the notion of consent. And we hear quite often this idea played out in the media that a woman's consent, once given, can never be retracted.
Mm-hmm.
If you've given it to one man, you know, you give it to him for all time. So I was really interested in this notion that superficially, Jonathan is consenting verbally and even in writing. He has to sign this contract that he will be submissive to the Vague and he will be sexually available to them at all times. But could you say that's really consent?
Mm.
You can say, well, that's informed consent. I mean, heck, he's read a contract and signed it.
And he can't predict all the other things that are going to occur.
No.
So it's difficult, no, isn't it, to say that you give consent to everything, because how can you?
I just want to return to that couple of paragraphs I just read, mm-hmm. and this notion of submission and free consent. And I think it's really interesting when you think about religious orders and even, military institutions, that obviously for a lot of people there's something quite profoundly attractive about handing over some of your decision-making faculties, about having the administrivia, the questions of your life, just giving them to somebody else.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought of it in that framework. But when you talk about, you know, religion, you talk about joining up the army and stuff, I think you're absolutely right. Adalia says, what do you know about consent? Adalia spat the words at him. A girl comes into a firm like yours after years of study and slog. She's special, different. She's one of the chosen ones. Her friends know it and they resent her a little. Her parents are bursting with pride. And she becomes a person apart, alienated from where she came from, not quite sure-footed in this new world she finds herself. So when she finds out what's expected, what's required, how much choice do you think she has? And so it's really interesting how Adalia is more concerned about his lack of knowledge of consent more than the infidelity.
I love Adalia.
Yeah,
I must
so
admit, one shouldn't have a favourite child.
I thought she was just so full of life and so different to what he'd experienced. I mean, even his mother wasn't very keen on her because she was just this different woman.
That's true, but isn't that the nature of human relationships, you can't account for alchemy between two people.
Mm-hmm.
You think about all the people you know who strike you as really oddly paired. And, you know, on many levels, Adalia and Jonathan are really oddly paired.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a vital connection between them.
Absolutely. And it's at the heart of the story. The book is about love, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it is about the labours of love and atonement and redemption.
And love for a child, love for a spouse, and even that kind of lack of love for oneself, which we find as we go on the journey with Jonathan. He really doesn't have any sense of self. He surrounds that, or he bases that upon, you know, his self-worth at work and Adalia. And he says Adalia, who was solid and real, effectual in a way that he was not, loved him. And so he finds out the hard way that he actually he needs her.
Mm. And, you know, it might surprise you to know how much of me is in Jonathan.
Oh, wow. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm very driven and I've always been highly self-motivated. And I think when you're like that, it is actually really easy to fall into the trap of thinking that the things you acquire and the things that you achieve and attain equal progress.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow there's movement and trajectory and those things are important. And that's something I find really easy to fall into. So I think I understand the dynamic that motivates somebody like Jonathan, because you can so easily convince yourself of the meaning of those things and how they bolster you and convince you that you know, oh no, I'm having a meaningful life. Yeah. I'm doing important things.
That's a common problem, I think, in our society, the accumulation of wealth or stuff, which, you know, has been proven. It doesn't actually provide you with any happiness or extra happiness.
Mm. I was really struck. It was earlier this week, a girlfriend of mine who's recently moved to Adelaide, and she was musing on a Facebook post about taking the bus home from work and noticing things about the light and her new hometown. She's one of those people who you really get the impression she's present in every moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not a gift I possess. My mind is always moving on to the thing I need to get done in the next half an hour and the half an hour after that. So I confess I probably do have a bit of sympathy for Jonathan, because maybe if I had been born a boy, I would never have had the prompts to think about those things differently.
And I think as a reader, we had empathy for Jonathan as well. I know I did. No, he did some pretty ugly things and he was complicit in some even uglier things. But he was a complex character in that way, that he had this willingness to go to the fortress for his unborn child, who he just loved without even knowing, you know, his protection of the young girl at the fortress, his loathing of the pedophile and his attempt at redemption. So he did have some redeeming qualities. And it's interesting that you said that you sort of felt, you know, a bit of affinity with him, because maybe that's why he came across as such an empathetic character, because you did put yourself in it. And that's what we are. We are complex human beings and we do horrible things, but we're also, you know, we can atone.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that. I worry anybody listening may assume that The Fortress is a really didactic text.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's not. It is actually really character-driven. And although, yes, it is a novel of ideas, it is also a character novel. I hope that the politics isn't beating the reader around the head.
I didn't find it that way. I must say I did find sort of similarities and parallels to The Handmaid's Tale, but I think, as you said, that's, you know, been a common response. But I think there was a lot of character, and I found myself thinking and stopping and going, wow, he's done some pretty ugly things, but I actually have a lot of empathy for this guy, because you're right, even I could see myself in some of what he was saying. You know, I don't work in a corporate world anymore, I used to, but you could see yourself in parts of that, and then you thought about the ugly things that you might have done or been complicit in,
Now, you could have done those things differently, because he looks back and in his head he thinks, well, what could I have done differently? And that's all you can do, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it I honestly don't know the answer to that question. For various reasons, the question of accountability is really front and centre for me at the moment. But, you know, as I was writing the book, another thing that occurred to me was, in the past, the distant past, we had public stocks. And I'd always thought of that, you know, as a really primitive, ghastly thing. But then I came to think, well, maybe that sort of thing does in fact serve a purpose, because the individual takes their place in a public space and says, yep, I did something crappy, I owe something to my community, I'm going to stay here for a defined period of time and I'm going to take your insults and your rotten fruit and your jibes. And at the end of that, we're going to say, okay, we draw a line under it and we start again.
Mm.
And we really don't have comparative rituals for that, do we? And I think that's part of what Jonathan is really struggling with. You know, even before he goes to the fortress, he has this nascent awareness that what has been going on at his firm is not okay. And he's struggling for a way to write something that he can't name. In a way, I think the fortress is almost the stocks.
I love that. I love that idea.
Yeah, of what a psychological stocks might be.
Well, that is so interesting. And, you know, we're talking about atonement and we're talking about how Jonathan, you know, we feel like he kind of does atone for his sins and he does have a moral compass. At times it's ambiguous, but, you know, there's times where he does find it. But there's also that sense of atonement. I don't want to give too much away for listeners who haven't read it, but the man in the fortress with him, he's unable to atone because I think there are certain crimes you commit that no matter what you do, atonement is probably impossible.
Well, certainly in Vaic philosophy, so the Vaic have no God.
Mm-hmm.
They do not believe in a hereafter. And they believe that certain human beings are, in the Vaic language, is vestiae, which means that they're beyond redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in Vaic philosophy, they effectively cease to exist.
Yeah, and they get turned to dust.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. So once a person so named dies, the family of that person can actually seek to have them totally removed from the public record.
Mm. It was interesting, the moral ambiguity in the novel, and that's what I liked about it too, because I kept stopping and thinking about where my moral compass was as well, because Jonathan is asked to do a lot of difficult things in the fortress, which, you know, if you're outside of the fortress, you may not agree with, but he has signed, you know, his form to be submissive. And it's interesting of what's acceptable in the fortress and not acceptable in the world that he lives in. So he has to come to terms with that as well, which I guess parallels his corporate world, you know, because they had their own set of rules, didn't they?
That's it. And when you think about rape, I mean, apparently we condemn rape. It's a crime. We abhor people who do it. And yet it is an everyday, almost banal occurrence. You know, there is a difference between things that are prescribed and what is actually tolerated.
Mm, absolutely. And obviously misogyny plays quite a large part in the novel. And Jonathan says the reason many men don't sign up to the fortress is because what man, after all, wanted to serve a woman? And you combine this with his corporate culture he is part of and complicit in, and misogyny runs so deep in his society and can be so hidden or subtle that perhaps people don't see it or they don't choose to see it. And I was thinking when you were talking about the stocks and the fortress, how do we get people to think about these things in a new way, you know, about consent and about misogyny, if we don't have the stocks and we don't have the fortress?
Mm. Well, hopefully people will read the book. I want to be clear here. You know, it's not like I have all of the answers.
No, of course not.
I'm just a novelist. I write. Well, certainly this book was a bit of a thought experiment, and I don't have answers, but I do believe that there can be empathy, and that we can weaponize our imagination to try and understand what someone else's experience is like.
And I love books that bring up more questions than answers. You know, I didn't expect you to sit here with all the answers for me or our listeners, but I love books that make you, and that's why I did. I loved this book so much, and I actually put it in one of my, you know, number one of my top five reads this month, because I just thought it was such a powerful book, not only because, as you say, the messages in it, but the characters. I really felt for these characters, and I loved Adalia, and I had empathy for Jonathan, and I really liked the characters in The Vake as well. I thought they were so interesting. I would have even liked more of those people. So I found... you know, the novel just such a powerful sort of mirror of our society. And when it brought up more questions, I thought it was interesting because it makes the reader really think about where they stand on all of these issues and their own experiences with these issues.
Are we allowed to go to the you late situation?
Oh, go for it.
So that's the one that's actually really polarised my girlfriends.
Okay.
So I have a really tight group of girlfriends, and they all read. And so for people who are listening and who may not have read the book, one of the characters is a young Vake girl. She's 13 or 14. And she develops a bond with Jonathan that he responds to very paternally. He associates her really strongly with his unborn child. And without giving too much away, that's not how you late understands the relationship, which puts Jonathan in a tremendously awkward position, and it just really polarized my girlfriends. But I just, you know, I love the idea of a world where women are encouraged to embrace their sexuality as this joyful, pleasurable thing if they want to. The key tenets of Vake society is this notion that freedom consists in the freedom to and the freedom from. And each individual needs to decide in what measure those things are best.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's compulsory that every Vake needs to be rapaciously sexual. Quite the opposite. But the choice is there.
I also liked the idea of what it means to be a man or a woman and how Jonathan oversimplifies it. And Mandalay states that womanhood is not an absence. And she says, you know, if I tore off your manhood, does that make you a woman? I thought that was really interesting, the idea of identity as well.
Mm. That's right. So for the Vake, although it's a very, you know, it's a profoundly female-centred organisation, they don't believe that femaleness equates to a particular biology. So there is this notion that the thing that makes you Vake more than anything physical is a state of mind. And if you can inhabit that state of mind, male, female, indeterminate, then you can be Vake.
Something that we can probably learn in our own society as well, instead of that oversimplification that Jonathan adheres to.
Oh God, we love a neat binary, don't we?
Yes, put everyone in a little box. You're this or you're that.
Yeah.
Where we seem to be afraid of, you know, things that aren't in boxes, which is interesting, isn't it?
I wonder where that comes from. Our discomfort with nuance. Is it just that we've been profoundly dumbed down?
It also could be representations in our media. I mean, I know it's getting a lot better. I mean, I've read a lot of young adult fiction with, you know, quite a diversity of different characters. But, you know, I guess that's what we see, what we're exposed to constantly, isn't it?
Mm.
Now, we have established that the book has a lot of issues that makes us think, but it's also a really character-driven book as well. Can you tell me what your writing process is? I mean, you said you kind of were just ready to write this book because of your, you know, femaleness and your experiences as a human on this planet. But did you always have a strong structure for this novel, or did you let the character drive the story? What was your writing process?
I started this book in the most sublime circumstances. I was in Thailand on a holiday with my family. My sister and her partner were there. So in the morning, I would find myself a spot under a palm tree and I would write. I didn't have to be anywhere. I didn't have to prepare meals. I didn't have to clean up. I just had this extraordinary space and comfort. And I had that for about 2 weeks. And I would write probably till about lunchtime. And then in the evening, we'd all come together and I'd have the opportunity to talk about the ideas and characters I was experimenting with. And it was just so fruitful, such an idyllic environment that by the end of that 2 weeks, I had sort of 15, 20,000 words mm-hmm. of what became the book. Now, I've never really had that before. I work full time, I work excessive hours, and my writing is always stuffed at the margins. So I just started out with this idea of a man arriving at the borders of something like the Vatican, into which he's going to disappear, and it's going to be a very female-oriented civilization. So I just started with that idea. But it wasn't until later, because I was really struggling with structuring the book,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't until I hit on the idea of dividing it into the four vague seasons that I had a really tight structural architecture to move the story along. But look, I'm not really a theorist when it comes to writing. I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it's entirely shit. So, you know, I work it and I work it and I work it until by degrees it's less shit.
I love that honest response though.
But it's true. It is slog. Yep, there are those wonderful moments of, you know, inspiration and energy. But for me, it is 95% slog and bloody mindedness.
Mm-hmm. And I think if most writers, you know, are willing to admit that, I think that's absolutely true. You know, that whole writing process, it just takes, you know, we talk about a lot of talent, a bit of luck, but wow, a lot of hard work and time. You know, like you said, you didn't have to make meals and clean up, and all those things kind of hinder that creative experience, doesn't it?
Oh, it really does. And I hear people say, oh, I don't have the time to write. I have all these ideas, but I just, you know, I don't have the time. And I'm pretty dismissive, actually, of that excuse because no one has the time. Okay, probably there are some people who have the time, but in my experience, they're pretty bloody rare. Everyone has to work. You might get the occasional grant. I've never had one. And I made the decision some time ago to stop applying for them because they ate into my writing time.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to write, just write. Yeah. And it is as simple and as difficult as that.
I like that. As simple and difficult. You talked about your publishing process and how some publishers were a bit afraid to touch the novel. Can you take us through this experience and then eventually how you did get it published?
So I had a really funny run with this book. I got a wonderful agent in one of those dream sequences. So I emailed her, I think it was on a Wednesday, and said, look, this is the synopsis of my book. Would you like to take a look at it? And she came back and she said, yeah, sure, send it through. So I sent it through. I got a text from her on the Friday night saying, haven't finished it yet, but yeah, definitely want to pick this up, which is just unheard of, certainly for me. And then we put it out to publishers and we got a series of responses that were just, they ranged from the anodyne to the bizarre. The one that sticks in my mind was, it said something like, this may well be a work of genius, but I'm not brave enough to publish it. You know, people saying, oh, it's a bit I don't quite know what genre it is. And this just baffles me.
Yeah.
So this idea that unless I can put it in a genre box and know what kind of cover and what kind of font that's going to be, I can't publish it because I can't possibly exercise my imagination to think about how I could find a market for your book.
And what shelf does it go on? I mean, come on, if it doesn't fit in, like, sci-fi, what shelf do you put it on?
And this is one of the things that has continually surprised me about the world of literature. You know, we have these notions about, you know, the art world being, you know, so freeform and so boho. That is utter shite.
Mm.
It is really conservative.
Yeah. I thought that too when you said you had publishing, you know, some of the publishers weren't, you know, kind of, we'll say brave enough to publish it. But I mean, that's what literature is. You don't have to read it, but it's out there. And I loved it. When I picked up this book and I read the blurb, I was like, I cannot wait to read this because I just thought how interesting and how different and how unique is this book. So I'm glad you got it published.
Thank you. And look, in the end, all of the dithering of the other publishers was to my advantage because I got to work with Angela Mayer,
mm-hmm.
who immediately, she just understood the book. She grasped it straight away.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent, in her pitch for the book, sent a message to my agent saying, it's so interesting to get a dystopia that's actually a utopia.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, yes, thank you. I'm working with an intellect. So yeah, she's just bloody fantastic. Can't rate her highly enough.
And you're not the first person on this podcast who have said that. Her name seems to be popping up quite a lot.
she's amazing. I mean, sorry, I'm going to segue a little bit here too. Just read her first long form book, and it is a cracker.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually getting a copy from her because I'd love to interview her about it. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, I read it in two sittings. So mm-hmm. Angela's just one of those people. She's got such an eye for literature. And, you know, the people that she's signed, you know, Emma Visick and, you know, the tattooist of Auschwitz.
Yep.
So anybody out there who's, you know, got a manuscript.
And it doesn't fit into a specific genre and you're not sure what font it has.
That's right. Angela Mayer.
She can think outside the box.
Well, she can.
Well, that's great that you said with the dithering, you got to find your person. And that's what it's about, isn't it? You're finding the people who get it and understand it and want to make it work. As a reader, I was one of those people who just got stuck into that book and I loved the ideas about it and I really enjoyed it. I'd be recommending it to all my friends, both male and female, because I think it's such an important book for both genders to read.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. And I think too, you know, people have been saying to me, it's a page turner.
Mm.
It's not stolidly intellectual. The ideas are there, but they're scaffolded into the novel.
Mm-hmm. But there's so much to talk about afterwards. So I've been telling everyone when I'm reading, oh, just I've got to tell you this idea. What do you think about this? I've been annoying everybody. So what's next for you? You've made, you know, you've got this incredible book with all these issues. Like, as we said, it can be read just for absolute pleasure. But if you want to think about it like the English nerd that I am, you can do that too. What's next for you?
Believe it or not, I'm writing a romp.
Oh.
Yes. So all my writing life so far has been on really weighty topics in many ways.
Yep.
And at the end of The Fortress, I thought, you know what? I just want to write something that's fun. Unabashedly fun. So I'm writing a book called Brian, and it is about a young forklift driver, Brian, our hero, who is accidentally made a vampire by a drug-running bikie clan. And one of the side effects of his vampirism is it cures his dyslexia.
Oh.
So the premise of the novel is, you know, is it better to be a blood-sucking fiend or go your whole life and not read Middlemarch?
Interesting. And look, I'm a bit of a secret vampire lover here, so I'll look out for that one for sure.
It's a question we've all asked ourselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've always wanted to be secretly bitten by a vampire because I think, you know, there's a lot of glamour in being a vampire. I've been watching the wrong movies, obviously.
well, my Brian is not the not the typical vampire. He's very working class. He's not very glamorous. He wears plaid. But he's adorable.
I'm thinking about the Lost Boys, I think. Well, I like it. You know, I don't think I've read many novels where the hero is a forklift driver, and I think it's time I did.
Well, look, finally I get to use my knowledge from working in transport and logistics.
That's so great. I love it. What do they say? Write what you know.
Oh, well, I've never really done that before. This is novel for me.
That's great. It's been absolutely amazing talking to you. Like I said, I absolutely loved your book and I rated it my number one top five books under 5 minutes in my review because I just thought there was so much to think about in the book and it's so relevant for our society too. You know, it made me think about where I stood and, you know, where my moral compass was and the industries that we've worked in and what we've experienced as people. So I thought it was really interesting. So thank you very much for writing it and thank you for coming on today.
It's such a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.